Okay, good evening and welcome to the first session of the Renaissance Reinterpretations of the Ancient World course. My name is Maria. I'm a research fellow here at the University of Warwick, and we will be doing the first session together. It's lovely to see so many friendly and enthusiastic faces. I'm sure we will have a great time. So today we are doing Ariosto, Ludovico Ariosto, who is one of the major poets of the Italian Renaissance. And he is best known for his chivalric poem Orlando Furioso, or The Mad Orlando. This poem might not be extremely well known in Britain. I don't know how many of you heard about it. I'm not surprised. It's certainly not as well known as The Divine Comedy or Boccaccio's Decameron, but it is actually an acclaimed literary masterpiece of the Italian Renaissance, and a work that fascinated countless generations of readers and poets, including such important figures as Voltaire. Voltaire adored the Orlando Furioso. He thought it was amazing, much better than the epics of antiquity. You might not agree with him, but that's what he thought. Or Galileo Galilei also was a great fan of Ariosto. So the Orlando Furioso is a fascinating read, but it's an immensely entertaining text, but it is also a rather challenging text. As some of you might have already guessed, first of all, because of its length, it is extremely long. It consists of 46 cantos. It was only 40 cantos in the first edition that was published in 1516, so 502 years ago. The third and final edition contains 46 cantos, and that comprises nearly 5,000 stanzas of 8 lines each. So to read it in its entirety is actually a remarkable feat. But I have done so more than once.
Wow, well done.
What you have read in preparation for the first session is less than 5% of the entire text. It is already a lot. And another challenge is that the poem contains countless characters. So I once tried to count all the Saracen or Muslim characters that populate its pages, and I counted more than 140 characters, only Muslim characters, and there are as many Christian characters, and then there are various monsters, mythological figures, and so on and so forth. So that makes the Orlando Furioso a rather challenging text. And of course, as you would expect in a poem with so many characters, it has many different plots. There are several principal plots, but then there are countless secondary plot lines, which sometimes makes it quite difficult to make sense of the Furioso. So if you feel confused at any point in this session, that's normal. Even Ariosto's first readers, his 16th century readers, sometimes got confused and complained about its length, even though they absolutely loved the poem. So if you are a bit overwhelmed, just ask for an explanation. So to begin with, let me say a couple of words about Ariosto himself. So that is Ariosto. That is probably Ariosto. This might be his portrait by Palma il Vecchio. a Renaissance artist, and if you happen to go to London and happen to visit the National Gallery, you will find it there. Mm. So Ariosto was a rather handsome man, as you can see from this portrait. So he was born in 1474 in Reggio Emilia to Niccolò Ariosto, who was an employee of the Duke of Ferrara, Ercole I d'Este. In 1484, the family moved to Ferrara, where between 1489 and 1494, following the wishes of his father, Ludovico studied law at the local university. So his father wanted him to become a lawyer. And this is quite typical if you look at the fathers of great Italian writers. Petrarch's father wanted his son to become a lawyer. Petrarch hated law. Boccaccio's father also wanted Boccaccio to study law. And again, Boccaccio hated it. And Ariosto was no exception in this respect. So instead of studying law, he applied himself to the study of Latin under the guidance of Gregorio da Spoleto, a prominent humanist. And he also participated in the vibrant cultural life of the ducal court. And in this period, he established friendships with eminent humanists and poets, such as Alberto Pio da Carpi, Ercole Strozzi, and Pietro Bembor. And he also took his first steps as a poet. So he started by composing poetry in Latin. He first tried his hand at Latin, and only then did he turn to literature in the vernacular. Then in 1500 his father died, and Ludovico was left in charge of a large family. So in 1503 he entered the service of Cardinal Ippolito d'Este, who was a brother of the ducal heir Alfonso. So he was one of the sons of the then Duke of Ferrara. Ludovico Ariosto also took minor orders, which enabled him to receive ecclesiastical benefits. And as the courtier of Ippolito d'Este, of Cardinal Ippolito d'Este, Ludovico was expected to carry out a variety of tasks, ranging from administrative work to diplomatic missions to Rome during the War of the Holy League. So while Ludovico Ariosto was composing the Orlando Furioso, various battles were being fought in Italy, and Ludovico witnessed it all. He participated in the political life of Italy. He saw from close up all the dramatic events that were happening at the time, and he makes numerous allusions to contemporary politics in the Orlando Furioso. And when in the second half of the present session we'll look at some of the readings you did at home in preparation, we will see that they do contain some references to what was happening in Italy at the time. So, by the way, this session, as you already know, will be divided into two halves. So the first half is my introduction to the Orlando Furioso, to Ariosto, to Ariosto's engagement with classical culture. And then the second half, after the tea break, will be a seminar where we will discuss what you have read at home, and it will be more interactive. But of course, even now, do feel free to ask questions, do feel free to interrupt me with questions or queries. So Ariosto embarked on the composition of the Orlando Furioso in 1504-1506. The first edition, a 40-canto version was printed in 1516, and here we have the title page of the first edition. It is quite beautiful, isn't it? This is a copy which he had illuminated and which he then gave to the King of France, Francis I, as a friendly gesture. It is beautifully illuminated.
So, and is this it illuminated all the way through, or just the title page?
Just the title page, okay, unfortunately. Right, okay.
And is the bottom, is that a coat of arms? Or
yes, yes, that's a coat of arms.
Of the
king.
Of himself?
Mm-hmm, yes. Of the king, yes.
Oh, of the king.
Of the king, yes. Yes. Well, because I also had to pay for this first edition of the poem, so he couldn't afford to have it illuminated.
The whole way through. Yeah,
the
yeah,
whole way
yeah.
through. Sure. So he chose, but at least he paid for the first page. And this motif is called in Italian Bianchi Girari, or a white vine stem border. It actually originated in the 15th century in Florence, and it was often used to decorate humanistic texts, so serious texts, not chivalric poetry. And maybe by using this beautiful motif, Ariosto is also stressing the fact that his poem is a serious text, rather than simply one of the countless chivalric poems that were produced at the time. So soon after the publication of the first edition of the Orlando Furioso, his relationship with Cardinal Ippolito deteriorated because the Cardinal failed to appreciate the poem, or so Ariosto felt. Although he failed to reward him as Ariosto wanted to be rewarded. And then the cardinal decided to move to Hungary, and Ariosto told him that he was not coming with him. And that was the end of their relationship. But rather than leaving Ferrara, Ariosto entered the service of the cardinal's brother, Duke Alfonso I of Ferrara. So until the end of his life, he maintained a close relationship with the ruling family of Ferrara, the Este family. Apart from the Orlando Furioso, Ariosto also wrote comedies, well, works in Latin, especially in his youth, also satires. But the Furioso was his main literary undertaking, and he kept working on it until his death in 1553. So the third and final edition was published in 1532. This is an enlarged edition. It contains extra 6 cantors. And also Ariosto made many linguistic changes to it, to make it comply to the new linguistic norms. But still, he was not completely happy with it. And maybe if he hadn't died, I think he would have continued working on it, and we would have the 4th edition, maybe later on the 5th edition.
I can't see very well, but is he writing in Italian or in Latin?
In Italian.
In Italian, so yes.
It says, Orlando Furioso di Ludovico Ariosto da Ferrara allo illustrissimo e reverendissimo cardinale Donno Ippolito da Este suo signore. So it's a dedication to Ippolito d'Este, to Cardinal Ippolito. And he kept this dedication even when he and Ippolito were no longer on speaking terms. He decided to keep it. And which is quite unusual if you think about it, because many other intellectuals at the time would dedicate their works to whoever put... help their careers.
Why did he
send a copy to Francis I?
Because, like many Italians at the time, he really liked Francis I. Like, Francis was young, he was chivalrous, and Ariosto and many of his contemporaries thought that maybe Francis would be able to put an end to Italian warfare, to the Italian wars. Again, I mean, this did not happen. And Francis was not successful in pacifying Italy, and his political career really was quite tragic. There are references to Francis I in the Orlando Furioso. Both in this first edition and in the final third edition. And by the time Ariosto published the final third edition, it was clear that Francis was no longer a figure who could save Italy. Yet again, Ariosto decides to keep all the stanzas dedicated to Francis. Well, as a way of showing his loyalty. So, what is the Orlando Furioso? What is the Orlando Furioso or the Mad Orlando? It is a chivalric poem, and as such, it draws on the European vernacular heroic tradition that goes back to the Chanson de Roland. Some of you may have heard about the Chanson de Roland. It's probably the most famous old French epic composed at the end of the 11th century, so more or less contemporaneous with the First Crusade. And it recounts the death of Roland, who then becomes Orlando in the Italian chivalric tradition. Oh, so Roland and Orlando are one and the same person. He is He is like this one of the superheroes of the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. So not only the Chanson de Roland and the Orlando Furioso talk about his exploits, but many, many other chivalric texts in different European chivalric traditions. So we have an extremely vast body of Carolingian texts. So Carolingian texts about the exploits of Charlemagne, Roland or Orlando, and other French knights. So Ariosto, in a way, with his Orlando Furioso, joins this tradition. He joins a vernacular chivalric tradition that exists, that already existed, that has been there since the 11th century and maybe even earlier. So the Furioso is greatly indebted to that tradition. It's also greatly indebted to the Arthurian tradition. So romances about King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. I don't know if you had time to read the first canto of the Orlando Furioso. Is it true that it has the feel of an Arthurian romance with knights going around looking for adventures, well, chasing Angelica?
I think so, yeah.
So maybe it did not strike you as particularly indebted to classical literature.
No.
But as a whole, the Orlando Furioso does draw heavily on the classical tradition. So these two traditions, the vernacular chivalric tradition and the classical tradition, meet in the Orlando Furioso, and both are extremely important.
When this starts, of courtesies and brave deeds, I sing, isn't that like the Iliad, similar beginning?
Well,
I'm sure.
What? That is a very good question. That is a very, very good question. Indeed, maybe like we can hear an echo of old epics, but love, for instance, is not one of the central themes in classical epics.
No.
Classical epics are mostly about the deeds of heroes. Homer in particular, but also Virgil. Well, Virgil does have Dido, for instance, in his Aeneid. But she is a secondary character. The poem is not about Dido and her relationship with Aeneas. The poem about the mission with which Aeneas was entrusted. So he is a hero who has to found Rome, and that is his mission. And for the sake of that mission, he sacrifices his relationship with Dido, and Dido dies, and it is very sad, but Aeneas does the right thing. So love episodes are present in ancient epics, but they are not extremely prominent. In the Furioso, as you can see already from the first line, love is one of the central themes of ladies, cavaliers, of love and war, of courtesies and of brave deeds I sing. In times of high endeavor, when the Moor had crossed the sea from Africa to bring great harm to France, when Agramante swore in wrath, being now the youthful Moorish king, to avenge Troiano, who was lately slain upon the Roman emperor Charlemagne. So what are the main themes of the Orlando Furioso? Love, I guess, and war. And these two themes are equally important. So in this respect, yes, these opening lines are actually very important. And also, he says, of ladies, cavaliers, of ladies and of knights he sings. Whereas, so, and that implies that there will be many characters in the poem. So not just one central character. Of course, later on he mentions Agramante, the Muslim king, the African king. He mentions Charlemagne, the leader of the Christians. But the very first lines imply that there will be many characters, not just one. Mm-hmm. And this is another difference with respect to classical epics, because in classical epics you usually have you have one central character. You obviously have other characters, but they are secondary, and the plot is driven by the adventures of the central character. For example, in the Aeneid, the central character is Aeneas. And hence, the Aeneid starts with, I think, Arma virumque canor, I think, of arms and of man, who is, as the man is Aeneas. Here, Ariosto doesn't do it, but if we continue reading. Later on, in stanza 2 and in stanza 4, he mentions two knights who I think are the central characters of the two principal plot lines. Orlandor, the hero mentioned in the title of the poem, and Ruggiero. So then he goes on, and of Orlando I will also tell things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme, of the mad frenzy that for love befell, one who so wise was held in former time. If she whom I poor talent by her spell has so reduced that I resemble him, will grant me now sufficient for my task, the wit to reach the end is all I ask. So, one plot line is centered on Orlando, who will go mad, as the title suggests. He will go mad because he is in love with a Saracen princess called Angelica, and this love is not reciprocated. So he is madly, passionately in love with her. She is completely indifferent to him. But he has convinced himself that she actually loves him. And why did he convince himself that she loves him? Well, maybe because in the preceding chivalric tradition, the best knight usually has the best damsel. So it's an unwritten formula, sort of an unwritten lore of chivalric romance, so to say. So if you are the strongest knight, if you are the bravest knight, then all the most beautiful ladies will fall in love with you. Even if they are Muslim or Saracen. And if they are Muslim, then they will run away from their family and follow you to France and convert to Christianity. So Orlando was hoping that something similar would happen, but clearly it does not happen in his story, which is one of the great innovations of the Orlando Furioso. But, well, we need to talk about the character of Roland first to understand why this is a huge innovation. Because in the Chanson de Roland, Roland is like a character who is not particularly interested in women. He is married, he has a wife who is back in France. She is a very minor character. She is in the spotlight at the very end of the Chanson de Roland when she learns of her husband's death. And then she cannot bear the news, so she dies. She drops dead. So very, very sad. And it is actually very, very sad indeed if you think that their marriage was never consummated. So Roland is married, but he is not interested in women in the chivalric tradition. Well, he is genuinely in love with his wife, but he told her that he would never sleep with her until he defeated the King of Spain and conquered Spain. And, of course, like many years pass, there are other adventures to embark on, so this actually never happens. And she patiently waits. And the Italians in particular like make fun of Orlando because of his chastity, because of this, well, I want to say stupid vow.
Almost if you're putting it off.
Yes, yes. Well, he put it off.
Give himself so big, yes, he can't possibly yes. do it.
So if you look at Italian chivalric romances composed in the 15th century or at the end, at the very end of the 14th century, you will see that Orlando is the only knight who is indifferent to women. And what usually happens is that, because he's so like brave and strong, what usually happens is that Saracen girls, queens and princesses fall in love with him. But he is extremely embarrassed when he realizes that they are in love with him. And he is often in very awkward situations when a Saracen damsel offers herself to Orlando, and any other knight would be extremely happy. But Orlando is like very, very distressed. So Italian chivalric poets poked fun at Orlando before Ariosto, because of his chastity, which is very different from how other French knights behave in these poems, because other French knights never miss an opportunity to have an affair with the Saracen princess, and then sometimes they marry their Saracen beloved. Sometimes they simply leave because actually they are married, they have a wife waiting for them in Paris. And then the poor Saracen princess would give birth to a boy, and the boy wouldn't know who his father is, and after 16 years he would find out the truth, and then he would go to Paris to meet his father and possibly kill him, but actually... Then when they finally meet, they realize that they have the same blood in their veins, and so the son converts to Christianity. This is a typical story. So if you read 15th century chivalric romances, you will find like many, many similar stories there. But Orlando is not like that. He is primarily interested in war. He wants to defend France from its numerous enemies. He wants to conquer new territories for France. But he does fall in love, and he falls in love before Ariosto. He falls in love in Boiardo's Orlando Innamorato, or if you translate it into English, Orlando in Love, which is a poem written again in Ferrara by Matteo Maria Boiardo, Ariosto's predecessor, another important Ferrarese poet who belonged to an earlier generation. So in this poem, Orlando falls in love with Angelica. So Ariosto did not invent the whole story, but in his sequel, Orlando goes mad because of that love. In Boiardo, Orlando is in deep crisis when he falls in love, because he doesn't know how to be in love, unlike his... His friends, but love for him is like a new feeling, but also a source of inspiration. So, and already in Boiardo, Angelica doesn't love Orlando. She is a cold, calculating, scheming lady who doesn't love anyone, and who simply wants to destroy Charlemagne and the French Empire. But Orlando, of course, doesn't see it. He sees her as an innocent girl, much in need of protection. So Ariosto invents the story of Orlando's madness. And of Orlando I will also tell things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme, of the mad frenzy that for love befell, one who survives was held in former time. also already at the beginning we know what will happen to one of the characters of the poem. But there is also another important character, Ruggero, whom he mentions straight after Orlando. Most generous and Herculean son, the ornament and splendor of our age, and I'm reading stanza 3, Ippolito, pray take as for your own your humble servant's gift, that men may gauge the debt I owe to you, which words alone cannot repay, nor ink upon the page. And let it not be said my gift is small, for giving this my lot, I give my all. So here Ariosto is speaking to Cardinal Ippolito, his lot, to whom the poem is dedicated. And then he says, among the heroes most deserving praise, whose catalogue of names I now prepare, Ruggero I will bring before your gaze, the founder of the lineage you bear. His valiant deeds, which time cannot erase, I will make known to you if you lend ear, and from your lofty thoughts your mind incline to grant admittance to this tale of mine. So Ruggero is not a simple character, but he is a dynastic character. He is the founder of the lineage you bear, so the founder of the dynasty to which Cardinal Ippolito belongs. And this is actually a huge innovation with respect to earlier chivalric texts. So for the first time, we have a dynastic character, a character who features not only in the story, but who acts as a bridge between the story and the audience. And I said for the first time, but actually this is not completely true, because again, Ruggero is invented by Boiardo. Ruggero is an interesting character. He is the son of a Christian knight and a Saracen princess. The Christian knight is called Agolante. The Christian knight is called Ruggero, and the Saracen princess is called Galacella. And these two characters feature in the medieval chivalric tradition. So Boiardo took them from the chivalric tradition and gave them a son. So Ruggero is treacherously killed in the Battle of Rizer, and Galacella dies of grief later on, and Ruggero, the little boy, is brought up by a magician who actually loves him and wants to protect him from his future, because that magician knows that Ruggero, when at a certain age, will become a great hero, will take part in Agramante's war against Charlemagne, which is alluded to at the beginning, in the very first stanza of the poem. He will fight on Agramante's side as a Muslim knight, as a Saracen knight, because Agramante is actually his relative through his Saracen mother. But then he will fall in love with a Christian lady and will convert to Christianity. And they will marry and they will have a son. And that son will be the founder of the Este dynasty. So that's the other plot line. So the one of the two principal plot lines is centered on Orlando. And Orlando becomes literally mad when he finds out that Angelica has been unfaithful. The other plot line is centered on Ruggero. And Ruggero, in the Orlando Furioso, is reunited with his Christian lady Bradamante, she convinces him to convert to Christianity. Actually, he is a bit reluctant to do so. At first he says yes, and then he thinks, oh my God, and what will my Saracen friends think of me? Isn't it wrong to convert when the war is raging and my king is actually losing the war? Everybody will say, oh, like this knight wanted to be with the victor, and that's why he converted. So he decides to postpone his conversion. But then he is forced to convert to Christianity in any case, because at the end of the war he wants to follow his defeated king to Africa, and he is caught in a storm, and all of a sudden he is afraid that he might die, and he thinks that it might be the Christian God punishing him for his unwillingness to convert. So he then makes a vow to convert to Christianity, and then he returns to France and marries Bradamante, and Ruggero and Bradamante have a child, but that happens afterwards. So let's talk a little bit about the classical tradition, which we should be actually talking about. So this very fact that Ariosto incorporates the dynastic theme into his poem is significant, because it links his poem to the Aeneid. So just as Aeneas is like the character entrusted with a noble mission, and the character who has to overcome obstacles to found Rome, to make history happen, so Ruggero has to like overcome many obstacles to become a Christian, and then to marry his sweetheart Bradamante, and to have that child. Only that, I don't know how many of you read the second, read Cantor 10 and Cantor 11, sort of the second half of the reading booklet. Don't worry if you haven't. We can. We were going to read some of it together in the second half of this session after the tea break. But if you have read it, you probably remember that Ruggero doesn't always behave like a hero should. So yes, he is modeled on Virgil's Aeneas, but he doesn't always live up to that ideal. Well, in fact, what distinguishes the Orlando Furioso from poems such as the Aeneid is Ariosto's superb use of humor and irony. So he doesn't take his knights and damsels completely seriously. He doesn't portray them as perfect human beings. All of his characters are flawed, and Ruggero is no exception. And as we're going to see in the second half of this lecture, of this session, Ruggero sometimes falls short of the chivalric ideal in a rather shocking way, as for instance when he attempts to rape Angelica, who has nothing to do with Ruggero. Angelica is Orlando's sweetheart. Ruggero has given his heart to Bradamante, and he knows that they are supposed to marry and to produce an heroic son. And yet, at one point, as we're going to see, he does not resist the temptation of attempting to rape Angelica. So Orlando, in this respect, is very different. He is only interested in Angelica. She is the only woman who possesses his heart. So he has given the whole of him, of his being, to Angelica, and that's why he goes mad when he finds out that actually his vision of the city, his understanding of the situation, doesn't correspond to reality, that she doesn't love him at all. But Ruggero is different, and Bradamante is also different, because Bradamante is actually... Well, she doesn't know that. She never learns that Ruggero attempted to rape Angelica, but she knows of his other infidelities, and she kind of forgives them. So this... Like, more successful characters are also characters who perhaps take life less seriously. Oh, this is something I forgot to show you. This is like a page from one of the most famous manuscripts of the Chanson de Roland. It's in Oxford, in the Bodleian Library. And this is a portrait of Cardinal Ippolito, so the man to whom Ariosto dedicated the poem. So Ariosto's Augustus, as Virgil wrote the Aeneid for Augustus, so Ariosto wrote the Orlando Furioso for Ippolito. Like 2 years ago, I organized a conference in Oxford to celebrate the anniversary of the first edition of the Orlando Furioso, because 2 years ago it was 500 years since the poem was first published. And I remember I was setting up the PowerPoint presentation of one of the speakers, and it contained this slide. Then somebody walked into the room, somebody who didn't have anything to do with the conference, and looked at this portrait and then told me, he looks really evil. I don't know if that's your impression.
Yeah, he doesn't look very nice.
He's very sly,
isn't he? The eyes are sort of turned around.
Very thin lips.
Yes,
thin
lips. Quite a serious mouth and jaw. Mm.
Oh, he was a bit younger than Ariosto. He was a man full of contradictions. He was a cardinal, but he was not particularly interested in religion, as most. And to be honest, he was not an exception, because most Italian churchmen were not particularly devout at the beginning of the 16th century. It was also like the period of the infamous Borgia family. Maybe some of you watched the soap opera, The Borgia Family.
Now, you said he wrote the Orlando Furioso for him.
Yes, yes.
So when you referred to Aeneid, is that written to anybody?
Well, it is for Augustus, the Emperor Augustus.
Oh, is it? It was. Mm. Oh, I didn't know that.
It is supposed to celebrate the Rome of Augustus. Mm-hmm. So that's like one of the men who descended from the fictional Ruggero.
But he had to make the character of Ruggero appealing if he was, you know, one of the forebears of this guy, presumably.
Precisely, and that was like a great challenge, I guess, to make him an appealing character while at the same time keeping the poem entertaining. Mm. Well, Ruggero does not go mad. He does not commit any serious crimes. And obviously, today, like attempting to rape a woman is actually a serious crime. But for like people like Ippolito, Dester, it was. I mean, a little weakness, you give in to to temptation, but like the woman is naked because he saves her, as we're going to see her after the tea break. Ruggero saves Angelica from a sea monster. She's chained to a rock, all naked, because she was captured by the evil inhabitants of the island of Ibudan, who feed beautiful women to a horrible sea monster. And Ruggero sees her as he is traveling around on his winged horse. He spots her and he obviously is moved by her distress. He decides to help her. He saves her from the sea monster. But then, when they reach the shore, he decides to take advantage of the situation. But luckily, Angelica escapes because she has a magic ring. If you put it in your mouth, you become invisible. So that's what she does.
You become
invisible.
Oh, wonderful. Invisible.
Invisible. So that's what she does. And the irony of the situation is that when he first sees Angelica in great distress, he immediately thinks of his beloved Bradamante. So he helps Angelica because for the sake of Bradamante, and then he completely forgets about Bradamante. But talking about the dynastic theme, well, Ruggero is not the only dynastic character, because we have a dynastic couple, Ruggero and Bradamante. And Bradamante is actually a much more convincing dynastic character than is Ruggero, which is quite innovative and revolutionary, to be honest, because we have a convincing, strong female character in a dynastic couple, and a less convincing male character, who is still portrayed as a hero, but he is clearly a flawed hero, unlike Bradamante. Because Bradamante is a warrior woman, so she is not a simple damsel like Angelica. She is very strong and very beautiful at the same time. And she is in love with Ruggero and only with him. And early on in the poem, she finds out that it has been decreed by God that they should marry and have a son, and then she does everything for this to happen. So Ruggero, he goes on different adventures, he wants to see the world first. Every time I reread the Furioso or I reread certain episodes that involve Ruggero, I can't help thinking that he is too young to commit to fail my life.
He's on his gap year.
Yes, yes. For example, at the beginning of the poem, Bradamante rescues Ruggiero from an enchanted castle where he was put by his stepfather, the magician Atlante. And his stepfather did it to protect him from his destiny, because he knows that Ruggiero will convert to Christianity, will marry, and then will die. And he will die by betrayal. He will be betrayed by somebody. And he doesn't want it to happen, so he wants to hide Ruggiero. So he lures him into that enchanted castle. But Bradamante finds a way to get there and to rescue him. And then they see each other and they are very happy. Obviously, Ruggiero is happy to see his lady. But there is also a winged horse there, which his stepfather used. So rather than, talking to his lady, Ruggiero decides to see how the wing horse works. So like a little boy who loves his, his mom, but is also interested in toys. So Ruggiero decides to saddle the wing horse, and the wing horse is an enchanted horse. So again, it carries him away from Bradamante to the island of an evil sorceress, Alcina, with whom then Ruggiero has an affair. And Bradamante forgives him because he thinks that it's magic. She clearly put a spell on him, but that is debatable.
Does it reflect Odysseus?
It does, it does.
Yeah, I wondered.
Precisely, and this is an episode modeled on a similar episode in Homer, when Odysseus is imprisoned by Circe. So that's how Ariosto incorporates episodes that are closely modeled on episodes and classical epics into his poem, but he does so in such a way that kind of romantic romance elements and epic elements coexist, and they form sort of a continuous whole. So here incorporates classical sources almost seamlessly. But obviously that was part of the entertainment for his first readers, because his first readers had a very good knowledge of classical literature, so they were able to recognize such episodes, and it was very enjoyable for them to see how Ariosto plays around with his classical sources. So Ruggiero, yes, sometimes he resembles Aeneas, sometimes he resembles Odysseus, but yes, but at the same time, he is a character from a chivalric romance. And a very, in the first half of the poem, at least, a careless young man who wants to see the world and to experience experience life to the full. Then in the second half of the poem, he is a tormented character, because when he is finally reunited with Bradamante and he promises her that he will convert to Christianity, he realizes that actually this creates a huge problem for him, as I told before, because he cannot simply abandon his Saracen friends in the time of greatest need. But Bradamante kind of wants him to do so, because she doesn't care about the Saracens. She wants to marry him, and for her, the Saracens are enemies. So Rogero is faced with this dilemma. Yeah, so on the whole, Bradamante is a much more Aeneas-like character than is Rogero. She is the one who wants to fulfill their dynastic mission and who takes it seriously and who does everything she can to make it happen. And in this respect, even though Rogero is flawed, the dynastic theme of the poem is not compromised, because we have like one flawed, like indecisive, slightly careless, at times weak character, but we also have a strong-willed lady, a strong-willed female character who makes the dynastic union happen. I think we've done the first hour, and it might be a good idea to have a short tea break. And then we will look at some of the episodes I mentioned, and at some other episodes as well. We will see how we will actually do some reading.
It's jolly hot up here.
It is hot.
Let's
try that. That was quick.
Wow. Yeah, we should have done it from the very beginning.
Well, I don't know. You have to see how much drop. Maybe we need to open it and shut it occasionally. It's all right if I burst now.
So we may have, I don't know, a 5-minute break. And
jolly good. Yes,
you
nice.
Can drink a cup of tea.
Okay.
Here.
Let's take out
here.
Yeah,
I have some orange juice.
No idea.
So I decided it was self-service this time.